Assalamu alaikum, Saima.
Walaikum salam.
How are you?
I'm okay, thank you. Thanks for having me.
No, thank you so much for coming on. I'm just going to launch right into it. I know you're a doctoral student. I wanted to just ask like a little bit about your background. How did you end up deciding to pursue doctoral studies? Was there something in your life that happened? You're like, I gotta have a PhD. I gotta be a professor. I gotta be in academia. Or was it something just sort of like the path you were following or something in the middle?
I think it was a little bit of both. So when I started off in my undergraduate, I decided to do sociology. I started having an interest in topics around like hate crimes and Islamophobia, things like this, because I kept hearing, you know, after 9/11, I grew up in an era where you're just hearing constantly about the kind of like news articles and media talking about Muslims in a certain way. And it just felt like it was too much, and especially Muslim women. So I had real interest in understanding why Muslim women are always painted as, you know, these women who wear the burqas or the hijabs and these kind of things. So I was always interested in the veil and in its context and what that actually means and why it's being portrayed so negatively.
Yeah. And so you're doing that in your undergrad, and then you graduate, and then what do you say to yourself?
Then I started thinking, okay, I need to do some kind of like master's, maybe finding out how I need to do my research methods, and probably learning a little bit more about like studies, about qualitative studies and things like this. So it was just one of those things when you just go along and you learn as you go. I didn't plan to do a PhD. I don't think at the age of 18, anybody kind of really knows what they're doing. It's just, you know, especially not me. I didn't have a career planned out in academia, but yeah.
Yeah. So how did you get interested in the whale? Like you said, you mentioned that, you know, there's like pervasive Islamophobia all around. And what prompts that to start looking at hijabs and burqas and niqabs?
Yeah, well, because I live in the UK, there was a lot of talk in the middle, I think, about whether they were going to do the ban or not because of France being a big influence. And then as a feminist, I didn't feel that it was right for someone to dictate whether someone should or should not wear a piece of clothing. It didn't make any sense to me that the fact that women's bodies are constantly monitored and controlled by wider society, especially in relation to Muslim women, because they're always portrayed as a negative character, somebody who's really, really, you know, like wrong in the eyes of the law, which doesn't make sense. How you can attach that kind of meaning towards a piece of clothing. So when I went on to do my proposal for my PhD, I actually got ready in terms of what kind of area I'm going to look into, the types of people I'm going to be working with. So about a year before, I started attending like local community centers to get a grasp of, like, you know, talking with the Muslim women, the kind of experiences they have, the kind of problems they face. So.
And so just for the American viewers, sometimes my students are surprised about the ban in France. Can you just give like a short summary of what happened in France and what is still happening in France?
Yeah, so there's an ongoing debate about the hijab, the burqa, and, you know, there's recently, the most recent up-to-date information is that the people wearing a hijab aren't actually allowed to go on things like school trips, and no religious item of clothing can be worn, and other facts like the burqa has been banned for a long time now. And I don't know whether this was just because of the rising Islamophobia that was growing, the fear of like terrorism somehow being linked to wearing a niqab or a burqa. But I think it's just that's the kind of dilemma that people were having when they were facing all these issues.
It's so weird when you say it out loud, it sounds so bizarre. And you really can't think of good logic behind it. I mean, how did you go about even studying all of this? What was your methodology? And how was all of this impacted by Islamic feminism for you?
Yeah, so basically my methodology was, like I said, went to the community center and I wanted to know about the experiences. Well, as a Muslim woman myself, I wanted to know other Muslim women's experiences too. I just thinking, I can't be the only one, and my family and my friends can't be the only people thinking this way, and why this hostility is suddenly growing, this fear of the hijab, or, you know, Muslim women being homogenized into this one group lump of, well, this is how a Muslim woman should be. And the pictures, obviously, on the media were painted across as all Muslim women veil, which wasn't true. So I didn't understand where that came from. So my methodology, bringing from that, I started thinking about focus groups and semi-structured interviews that I would do. So it would just narrate the lives of British Muslim women.
And then what are some of the themes that you saw, or like how did it connect all for to Islamic feminism for you then?
So with Islamic feminism, it kind of emerged while I was doing my methodology, because I was trying to find a way where I can look at the different dilemmas and different phases of Muslim women's experience. So when I'm doing my title for my PhD is Identity, Religion and Clothing. Now, those are very big, broad subjects, and I wanted them to intersect. So I use intersectionality to form my database. But I really found that when I was talking to the women, their religion was almost at the heart of what they did and believed. And, you know, as a way of life, they say for them, every day was about, you know, being the best Muslim that they can. So using that to reflect in their daily understandings and their daily struggles of being both very religious and also a feminist.
Yeah, giving voice to women's own, you know, own thoughts, own, they're like giving them or treating them as rational agents that are able to think about them, you know, their own projects, their own likes and dislikes and what they want to have on. I mean, I know that, you know, part of your research, you talk about concepts of choice and negotiation, and how that, you know, how Muslim women, how those concepts kind of impact Muslim women's everyday choices. And I wanted to ask you, what do you mean by these concepts of choice and negotiation? And then secondly, I want to also ask, like, how does this then impact how Muslim women see themselves in society?
So I was very careful to use terminology. I wanted the terminology choice there because one of the biggest things I found were constantly bombarded outside of academia, you know, outside of studies that have been done on Muslim women. We're bombarded with this notion that Muslim women are forced to wear certain areas of clothing. So I wanted that terminology of choice to be there, because for the women I spoke to, it was a choice. It was a choice from them. And many of them didn't have families that wore like a hijab or a burqa, but they themselves took on, you know, wearing it for their own religious reasons. So that was important. And negotiation, as in, I think every woman faces a negotiating task, or every person, I think, faces what to wear in the morning when they get up. And you're almost negotiating what you're doing, how you're behaving, what you want to. So, for example, you're going to an interview, you're going to wear more formal clothes. So how those negotiations took place in terms of Muslim dressing. So when I mean by the veil, I also talked about women who wear the traditional, like the hijab, the niqab, burqa, chadar, etc. But also women who don't choose to wear, how they, you know, for example, dress as a Muslim woman. And some women talked about how they didn't want to wear clothing that revealed their cleavage, things like this. So those were also negotiations constantly taking place in their everyday lived experience.
If I can just like sort of have you expand on that just a little bit, I wanted to ask, how is like somebody who's dominantly situated, like a cis, white, heterosexual, Protestant, Christian, like you're, you know, you're the most dominantly situated, at least in the US context. How is their negotiation in the morning on how to dress, how to be in the world, different than those that are not dominantly situated? And in this particular case, for Muslim women in particular.
So that's the thing. I think everybody's, you know, experience in the situation depends on who they are. So for example, a white heterosexual male living in a Western society would probably not have as many negotiations as, for example, the women I came across. They always had to think, okay, is it okay for me to wear this at a certain point? Is it okay for me to wear this within my community? Is it okay for me to wear this outside? Is it okay for me to, you know, go outside and maybe I might get, you know, I have to toughen myself up because I might be subject to harassment because I'm going into an area. Mm-hmm. And by harassment, I mean hate crime, going into an area that's predominantly not Muslim. So all those kind of negotiations, the everyday kind of struggles, whether it's just, you know, based on being a woman, or it's to do with their race, and or to do with their religious perceived, you know, Muslimness, which obviously they felt was, you know, sometimes in, you know, like a subject of hate crime whenever they stepped out.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I mean, that's something that I myself you know, sometimes like when I was not a citizen of the US and I'd be coming into the country, I would think about mm-hmm. how do I want to be dressed through immigration? Because I would be like, okay, I don't want to look too Desi. I don't want to look too Muslim. I don't want to look too whatever. I want to look to them like I'm, you know, that I'm not a threat to them. And figuring out what that would look for me while also keeping my values intact is something that I had to then think about, which kind of like plays into that second part of the question, which was that how does that impact Muslim women's ways of seeing ourselves?
So I think that was one of the most key important things for the women I studied. It was just about how they had to constantly have this battle with what do? Do they please the community? Do they please, wider society? Do they please people at their work? Or whether they take on, for example, one of the women I spoke to, she actually wore a niqab and she went to university to study. But she found that when she was on the train from her hometown into university, she often faced hate crime. So she had to constantly go through that, but she felt that her religion and her faith and her, you know, her ability to tackle all these was because she ended up negotiating that space and working around it and knowing that she has to ready herself. She almost had to kind of toughen herself up and prep talk herself before stepping out in some situations. So yeah, I think it's quite interesting when you listen to people's stories.
So you said something that I want to also maybe talk about a little bit more, which is that you said how we present ourselves within our own communities. And so have you observed that there's some moral judgment attached to how Muslim women are within our own communities, especially Muslim women who do not veil, and which are plenty of, like, it's not like it's, there's like a minority of Muslim women who choose not to wear a hijab or something, but is there like moral judgment? What kind of moral judgments, if any, did you notice?
I think the biggest thing for me was when I looked across literature, mostly it was so focused on women that veiled and that were Muslim. I felt there was a whole, you know, piece missing about women who don't veil, who don't conform to wearing a hijab. And the, like you said, there are plenty of women, Muslim women, who don't choose that way. So when they stepped out and they went to face community, they knew they had to wear certain attire, for example, like longer sleeve clothing, making sure that the legs are covered. But even still, they were faced with criticism and sometimes hostility within the Muslim community, saying, oh, well, you know, you shouldn't be dressed this way, or exclusion from spaces like, you know, mosque because, you know, the scarf isn't right properly, or you're not wearing a proper hijab, things like this. And negotiating spaces like swimming pools and understanding that women have to negotiate what they wear, don't wear in and outside of those spaces, because when you live in the West, there are those spaces that are open in places like America and the UK where women have to think about, okay, am I going to dress this way, but what's so-and-so going to say, or do I just not attend altogether because, you know, do I have to wait till this women's classes, all of these things, you
know, that. And like, what does that do to their moral standing if they are not meeting certain judgments?
Yeah, exactly. So I think they, in some situations, some of the women I spoke to, they got really, really piled down with, you know, you shouldn't be wearing this, you shouldn't be behaving like this. And these are women who are like late into their 40s, 50s. So not, you know, younger women that you'd expect, you know, having a telling off or anything. But yeah, even in that space, that they're mothers, and they still get told and they still get judged based on what they wear and how they look and what they present themselves. So I think, yeah, the presentation thing and finding out where they fit in that, along with, you know, keeping a balance on faith and everyday life, it was very important to them.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that certainly I've struggled with, I've also written about, which is the idea that when you are judged as a not a quote-unquote good Muslim because you're not dressed a particular way within the community or even outside the community, like somebody sees you and they're like, oh, you're without a hijab, you're not a good Muslim, quote unquote, that actually may end up making you think that you're not a good Muslim, might actually make you more distant from your faith rather than bring you into, I mean, or rather maintain your faith. I was going to say bring you into faith, but that person's already in faith and they feel distant by it. They feel, you know, they feel rejected oftentimes. And that can be very damaging to a person's sense of self.
It's interesting because I feel like in the Muslim community and outside community, this big, you know, like it almost feels like, you know, the ideal good Muslim that you talk about. I feel like there's this perception of how to be Muslim and how not to be Muslim. So especially in terms of dress, I feel like if you look a certain way, and it with even within community, you're automatically assumed that, oh well, this person is religious because, you know, they wear, for example, a headscarf, or if they don't, then well, they mustn't be religious. And it's just this whole interpretation of Islam being this homogenous kind of faith when it's actually not. That's so far from the truth. And you know, there's so many differences in scriptures and understandings, and you know, the ways one interprets religion, that I don't feel it's simple enough to define people as good and bad Muslims. But it's kind of it's really mind-boggling that that happens, fair enough, outside Muslim communities where they don't really understand that, you know, Muslim faith. But within even Muslim communities, it's kind of surprising that it's just black. It's almost painted as black and white, that you either are or you aren't.
Yeah, I mean, something you said just reminded me of this person, I think, who her name is Amani al-Khatabi, and she wrote the book, I think, called Muslim Girl, Coming of Age. And I read an interview long time of her, like long time ago of hers, where some, like, I think one of the questions was like, why do you wear the hijab, or like, or something, or describe your relationship to the hijab. I forget what the question was, but it was her answer that was very interesting, and I wish I had it on me. But essentially she said something like, it was like almost like a shorthand for both non-Muslims and for Muslims to indicate that she was Muslim, and that if she didn't wear it, that she wouldn't even be, even by non-Muslims, like liberal non-Muslims wanting to, you know, call on her for talks and for to be a spokesperson, she felt like she needed to wear it to, I mean, there were, she also gave religious reasons, but she said there was also this, almost this pressure to wear it because it was like a shorthand to non-Muslims as well, that I'm a good Muslim.
So I don't know how it is in America, but from, you know, obviously when I hear other podcasts or people talking about Muslims in America, they seem a little bit different to the ones in the UK. But in the UK, I mean, I've got the perfect example with my sister. She'd gone to university and she wanted to join the ISOC Society, which is basically an Islamic society at university. And then she literally got told she can't be part of that society, or she couldn't apply to be one of the chairs for
Oh,
that
wow.
society because she doesn't veil. So and that was almost like, well, you're not Muslim enough, because clearly if you want to be, then you have to wear a scarf, like a headscarf. And it was just so, you know, in a university space, you wouldn't expect that.
Yeah. So, I mean, so like there seems like there's like a massive spectrum of reactions, like from Islamophobic people toward women who wear the hijab, then within the community, also outside the community, of people trying to have like this short form for what a good Muslim is. I mean, what do you make of this entire spectrum where Muslim women exist in, where there's so much Islamophobia heaped onto us in right-wing spaces when we do cover, and then also kind of judgment attached when we don't cover?
Yeah, I just think it's just sometimes it's painted, like I said, as a dichotomy, as black and white, and thinking, okay, this is okay, this is not okay. So, you know, in all of these spaces, we have to understand that these women have to negotiate. So just as an example of I gave of my sister, where she was excluded basically of being part of a society because she chose not to wear a headscarf. There's so many examples of that. It's just negotiating within the community, outside of the community. You get vilified because basically you're brown and then you're a woman. And then on top of that, if you dress a certain way. So even if a brown person wears maybe a scarf around their neck, automatically they may not be Muslim, but they might be assumed or perceived Muslim because of their brownness, or the fact that that piece of clothing now is attached to being a Muslim. So it's just, you know, negotiating all these different spaces that women are exposed to. I think it's quite interesting. That's why it got me interested in doing this topic in the first place.
Well, I'm really grateful that you are interested in this, because a lot of studies that Muslim women have done on Islamophobia and the hijab look at women exclusively who veil and then present to us in sometimes inadvertently, not meaning to, but as this homogenous population. And I love the fact that you're looking at the complexity between between negotiating our space as Muslim women, both who veil and then don't veil. I also wanted to ask you, because one of the things that I saw as part of your research was it's all of the research's connection to the Me Too movement. And I wanted to see, how do you see all of this connect to the era that we exist in right now?
So basically, I started off this research with very simple objectives, looking at identity, religion, and clothing. Now, within that, I gave the scope for the women to decide to tell me what topics they wanted, like, you know, to explore, wanted to tell me. So I started off with focus groups. Now, within the focus group, within the first one, this topic, I think at the time I did this, the Me Too movement was going wild all over Twitter, and everyone was talking about the Harvey Weinstein kind of case. And, you know, it was really going big. And the women started talking about that within the focus group. And it was just something I didn't come across. And then they started talking about, you know, Moss Me Too movement, which, you know, emerged mm-hmm. and out of that. And it was about sexual harassment in sacred spaces. So they started talking about the experiences of sexual harassment within mosques and madrasas and, you know, communities. And I think this wasn't, as a Muslim woman, I know this isn't the first time I've heard it. It was very common, you know, as brown women, you kind of like, you hear about these stories, but it was interesting. I thought it was to include this into my study and talk about how they attach their identity and their clothing and how they negotiate spaces around sexual harassment. So where they're in mosques and what they do and how they negotiate what they need to wear and don't need to wear according to that.
Definitely, 100% agree. I mean, that's a research topic I'm also quite interested in. So I'm looking forward to you publishing your findings so that we can all benefit from it. Really appreciate, Saima, you coming on and having such a amazingly comprehensive conversation about the issues of clothing and our identity, because it was quite illuminating. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me and giving me the platform to speak.
Oh, no, definitely. Assalamu alaikum.